everyone is doing well. Had a nice week. Good to see folks again. Hope everyone's settling into some kind of summer rhythm of some sort. And for those of you with kids, that you are finding things for them to do, which is not simple. We tackled a long sugya last time, and I want to do just a little bit of kind of wrap up and reflection and one Tosafot that comes out of it. And then we'll take on two further sugyot, I think we'll get to tonight. Last time was a real focus on logic and various kinds of kal vachomer structures, trying to sort of argue from pairs of hierarchies in terms of which kinds of mitzvot or procedures supersede one another. And from here on in, we're heading into sort of a mix of some follow-up halachot about our section of the Mishnah, but also more and more Agadah, more and more Midrash. Eventually that's going to sort of blow open when we get to the last two and a half dapim of the chapter. So you'll start to feel that shift happening a little. Things are getting a little more like emotional and narrative in certain ways, as opposed to some of the more legal analysis that we've seen until now. So I want to just share here again, there's this document that I share stuff on the screen, but if you want to be in, that's the link over there that I just chatted, but you can also just rely on me on the screen. Just to show here again some of what we did last time, sort of boiling it down just into a little bit of charts here. We had a whole bunch of Amoraim weighing in, really four Amoraim, one of them Rava appearing twice, to try to make some sense of some of the categories that we saw here. Reish Lakish, you may recall, began with this move of, well, we know the Avodah, the temple service, supersedes Shabbat, and we know that dealing with an unattended corpse supersedes the temple service, because we talked about a mate mitzvah being something that even someone who's about to go work on a sacrifice has to go deal with. And that ought to lead to the notion that a mate mitzvah is docha Shabbat, an unattended corpse should be attended to even on Shabbat. We talked about it wasn't clear if Reish Lakish is actually making that argument, or it's a kind of, well, that's absurd. What's wrong with my logic? It seems like in his case, he's actually trying to make the argument. And then Rabbi Yochanan came back, and by throwing in the case of murder, which could either be dealing with a murderer, or it's possible murder here, I'll modify it just to sort of make that clear. There goes my spacing, can be execution, right? Actually executing someone on Shabbat, which is why this material got in here at all, because we had been talking about whether you can do executions on Shabbat. Given that murder or execution supersedes the temple service, which we know from Me'imis Bechiti Kachen Lamut, and we know this given of the temple service superseding Shabbat, that should equal, if Reish Lakish's logical moves are right, that murder and execution should supersede Shabbat. And yet we know that we do not execute people on Shabbat. That's how Rabbi Yochanan tried to take down Reish Lakish's reasoning. And then Rava is really the one who comes in and says, Bechol Moshvotechem, that verse that talked about, it was from Bamidbar Lamed Hey, talking about how the rules here are Bechol Moshvotechem, and that's a hyperlink to Lo Tevaru Esh Bechol Moshvotechem, led to some notion that actually Shabbat is more important even in a court doing some kind of execution. And that we had that sort of interplay between logic, a verse, the verse controlling logic, tamping it down. Sugya then went on to have Abaye offer this kind of additive theory. If Shabbat is more important than murder, again, murder or execution, that is to say we don't execute people on Shabbat, and we know that the temple service supersedes Shabbat, well, then that should add up to the temple service superseding murder or execution, meaning if there's a Kohen who needs to be executed for a capital crime, you do not pull him off the job, says Abaye, if this logic works out. And therefore, to the extent that there is a verse, Me'im Mizbechi Tikachenu Lamut, that you pull someone off the job of the altar in order to take them to die, to be executed, it must be that that principle only applies to the case of an individual's sacrifice. That is to say, when offering the Korban Tamid, public sacrifices, actually you wait for it to be completed until the person is completed that act, and then you can proceed with the capital proceedings. Here too, it was not totally clear. Was Abaye offering this as reducto ad absurdum, or actually getting to an argument, which we reflected on briefly, that perhaps actually there's certain kinds of public tasks that have to get done and are more important than dealing with the person performing them at that moment, immunity, all kinds of questions like that. And then Rava at the end of the sugya came back and talked about how Abaye's logic completely falls apart by noting that in an individual's sacrifice an individual sacrifice supersedes Yom Tov. Combining that with Yom Tov superseding murder should provide you with the notion that even an individual's sacrifice would trump murder. And then there would be no application of the verse, Me'im Mizbechi Tikachenu Lamut. And even if you were to follow the view, of which there is one, that if you invert the first column here and say that actually you're not allowed to offer individual sacrifices on Yom Tov, it still wouldn't make sense, because Me'im Mizbechi, my altar, implies removing someone from performing the Tamid. All right, that's just the sort of summary of some of what we saw there. And I broke up the sugya here schematically, underlining the Amoraim and bolding the Tanaim, just so you can have kind of a visual on some of what went on here. And here this got unindented, but sort of indenting things that are sub-thoughts, and allowing you to just get a sense of how that plays out. That's the sugya that we were on. I want to look at one Tosafot that comes out of that, which I think is interesting on its own terms, and in a way addresses Robert's question, or is at least playing with it a little. So it's this Tosafot here on the page. Shene'emar me'im mizbechi. Okay, so this is that verse, and claiming that, right, what we learn of this is that ritzicha is docha et ha'avodah. Okay, that the reason that you pull the person off is it teaches a principle that in fact, executing someone for a capital crime for which they are culpable trumps their place in the temple service. And then Tosafot asks an interesting and I think important question. V'im tomar, were you to object, demasherich tzicha docha et avodah, lav mishum de ritzicha docha et avodah, ela mishum de gavra lo chazeh. The fact or legal principle that execution supersedes the temple service is not because there's a principle that execution supersedes the temple service, but because that Kohen is not ra'ui lachaze. That Kohen is not valid, is not appropriate to serve. How can you have someone who's guilty of a capital crime performing the worship service on behalf of the people? And now a very strong proof of that, Kida Amrinan, Kohen sha'aragat ha'nefesh lo yisa kapav, sh'ne'emar yidechem damim maleu, v'chol shekein avoda. You have this pasuk in Yeshayahu, which talks about, right, your hands are full of blood, which is, you know, clearly kind of an expression and a way of talking about the people being guilty. But there's a halacha that is associated with, if not derived from that, which is a Kohen who has murdered someone is not allowed to offer the priestly blessing. By the way, this applies even harigah b'shogeg, even someone who accidentally kills someone. They don't actually have to be a murderer, okay? Someone who their hands led to another person dying. Their hands literally have blood on them. And therefore, they cannot get up in the synagogue or in the temple and offer a blessing to people. All the more so the avodah, all the more so the actual temple service itself. So the Tosfot would say, why are we having this whole thing of me'im mizbechiti kachenu lamut teaching this override? Isn't it about the person being inappropriate? V'yesh lomar, their proposed answer, de'al korchech chazi. No, you actually have to, even against your will, admit that a murderer is ra'ui, is actually valid to offer a sacrifice. Deha lo mechela avoda, because we actually don't find anywhere that the claim that if a murderer performs the temple service, it desecrates it and invalidates it. And if a person is really inappropriate for the job, then the sacrifice should be invalid. And we have no suggestion anywhere that that's the case, such that whether you like it or not, say the Tosfot, you have to accept the fact that the offering will still be valid. And how do you explain the priestly blessing piece? Nesiut kapayim chumra be'almahu. That's just the stringency. Like actually, technically, the murderer Kohen could also give the priestly blessing, but we don't like that. We don't want that. We want the person to take on a stringency, but really you therefore, for this reason, need this sort of more abstract legal principle that Ritzicha is docha et avodah. Not because the Kohen is not valid, but it just happens to be that executing someone who's guilty is named by the Torah as being more important than what's going on the Mizbeach. Ve'od yesh lomar, and a further argument you could make, deshane nesiut kapayim, actually the priestly blessing is unique. That whole thing where we said v'kol shekein avodah, well, if raising your hands to bless the people is invalid, obviously offering their sacrifices. No, it may be that nesiut kapayim presents a specific problem. Lefi sheharag biyadav, because murder or manslaying or whatever it is, happened with the person's hands. Ve'en kategor na'aseh sanegor, and a prosecutor cannot become a defense attorney. That is to say, you cannot lift up the agent of violence to serve as an agent of blessing in that moment. Kidichtiv b'ha'ukra uvefarischem kapechem alim einay mikem. If you look earlier, it says Yidechem Damim Maleu is the end of a verse that begins with, when you spread out your hands, I'm going to look at those hands and say, hey, those hands are full of blood, in a way that when you're offering the Avodah, you're using your hands, but it's not Nisiat Kapayim. It's not an action that is entirely wrapped up in the hands. So that's, first of all, I think, just like an interesting text on its own, the Kohen Sha'aragat HaNefesh Lo Yisar Kapav, and thinking about the ramifications of that. But here, too, I think you see the Tosfot playing with what I think is an interesting undercurrent in this sugya, which is, what are the limits of us sort of eliminating people as potential agents of doing something important, as opposed to holding them accountable for things they have done wrong? And those not necessarily moving in lockstep with one another. Good, okay. Yeah, why Ritzicha as opposed to Mitat Beitin? So again, I think there's a little bit of an ambiguity there of, is the Ritzicha, we are executing the person, in which case your question is very much in place. Or are we also dealing with the execution is really about a murderer, right? Because the verse is, v'chi yazid ish al re'ehu lehorgo ve'orma, me'im mizbechi tikachenu lamut. When someone in a premeditated fashion plots to kill someone, then take him away from my altar. So I think Ritzicha there is being used in a kind of double entendre way of, it is a murderer after all who we're talking about there, but we're also talking about killing him, right? All right, good. So interesting dimensions there. And this shows you a little more of, I think, some of the questions that this plays up. I'll just add, just because there are a couple comments here. So actually, this is still a live halakha in that it is assumed that these rules apply to Kohanim in the synagogue today. That is to say, in synagogues, in the diaspora in some synagogues, they never do it. In many synagogues in the diaspora, it's only on the Shalosh Regalim and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. In Israel, depending on where you are, in the Galil, it's every Shabbat. In a lot of other parts of the country, it's every day. The Kohanim still go up and offer a blessing to the community, and they do it with their hands. The general principle that someone who has killed someone is meant to disqualify themselves from that ritual remains. And you have really interest, there's a fascinating tshuva by Rav Ovadia Yosef where he goes through the question of what about a Kohen who killed someone in an automobile accident, like unintentionally? Can they still do Nisiyat Kapayim? And it raises these fascinating questions because on the one hand, there is this desire to allow people to rehabilitate. And in some ways to tell the Kohen he can never get back and offer that blessing means they have to carry that for the rest of their life. On the other hand, there is something about the sentiment here and Birkat Kohanim in general, where I think there's supposed to be some absolute sense of the plausibility of blessing flowing from this person. And so there's some very strong voices that say, I'm sorry, like it's not your fault. I'm not saying you can't atone, but you're just no longer fit to play this role. Like people know and you know that you killed someone. That just makes it impossible to move forward. So it's a very interesting thing. And he comes out, right, in a stringent and restrictive way on that. There's voices that try to find ways to be flexible, but they're juggling that same tension. Okay, good. And any other comments on that sugya before we actually bid it adieu?
Well, I thought a Kohen had a cure, and if he killed somebody, he'd be in the presence of a dead body.
So he would have to purify himself in the interim, right? The question is, but this is a life sentence, as it were. That's part of what's so intense about this. A Kohen who has killed someone, at least according right to the letter of the law of that teaching, for the rest of their life, is ineligible to ever offer the priestly blessing. And the Tosfot here, we're asking the question, maybe if you killed someone accidentally, you are disqualified for the rest of your life from offering a sacrifice. It seems at the end, they back off of that, right? They think that Nisiyat Kapayim is literally involving the hands in a certain kind of way. But in terms of, right, someone who is the main case we were talking about here, which is someone who is going to be executed, they're gonna be pulled off the job. The question is just, do you do it before they finish this act that they are in the middle of?
Well, if they have killed someone, then I don't know. It just seems like, why would you put them in front of, give them the opportunity to have a blessing? It's hard to kind of imagine why you would put them there to begin with.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's an obligation, which it otherwise would be on the Kohen, I think the question is less, why would you put them there? And more, does it rise to the level of, right, disqualifying them, right? You're disbarring them in that sense. And the only part where it becomes complex is when the killing was accidental, but nonetheless happened, right? But anyway, as I said, there's an interesting sort of trail of jurisprudence that runs through that. Okay, great. Abraham, go ahead.
The sense you get about the Kohen in general is that he's only a vessel. You know, he doesn't generate blessing. He doesn't generate anything. He's just a vessel. So when a vessel is no longer perfect, it's not usable anymore. And so it really doesn't depend on him. It's what the people associate with him. And if they associate death, or if in the case of a coin that has a mum, you know, a mum shouldn't make a person disqualified, except that psychologically we start thinking about the mum, and we think about death, and all those things we try to keep separate from the kahuna and from the Beis HaMikdash. And that there's a tremendous psychological reason for a lot of these things that I don't know if it's halachic, but it's certainly the drama and the theater of what a kohen is supposed to bring to you is spoiled.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely right. And I think just for, again, you can still have all sorts of struggles with it and questions, but I think it is a very helpful kind of metaphor and image to use of a vessel that like now potentially has a hole, right? And if it leaks, like it leaks, right? It may or may not be its fault. Okay, the question of right how you think about that and again what the balancing act is a fascinating one. All right, good. Let's go on. We'll take on our next two sugyot here. All right. So going back to the Mishnah, remember we're in this long list. We're finally almost going to get to the end of it. Differences between Dinei Mamonot and Dinei Nefashot. I'll just read you again. The next one, here we throw in a few others. Dinei Mamonot ha-tum'ot ve-ha-tahorot. The things, that monetary cases and things dealing with purity and impurity, matchilin min ha-gadol. Dinei Nefashot matchilin min ha-tzad. So the procedure when engaging a monetary case or something that's basically a call on ritual law is you begin from the most senior member on the court, whereas with a capital case, you begin from the side, which means from someone more junior. And what seems to be the meaning behind that is the normal way you proceed is the most senior person should get the seniority and the deference. But in a capital case, you are worried that that will silence the more junior voices, and you will potentially suppress voices for zechut, voices for acquittal. And therefore you reverse what's the normal chain of deference in those cases. All right, so now we're gonna get sort of a reflection. You'll see. I won't give too much commentary. Amar Rav. So Rav says upon hearing this Mishnah, Ana havai b'minyana devei rabi, u'minai didi havu matchalei b'resha. I was once in, literally the count, but meaning a court setting where we were counting votes. Okay, we were really meeting convening as a panel, and it was in the house of Rabbi. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who's Rav's teacher, right on the cusp of the Tana Idrak Amoraic periods here. And we began the judgment from me. Okay, we started from me. And the point is that Rav was junior on Rabbi's court, and he's reporting nonetheless that they began with him. And the assumption here is it is in a monetary case. In fact, Rashi fills this out. Havu matchale bereisha b'minyana de sikarikon amara Rav beperek hanizakin. In Gitin, there's a whole discussion of the sikarikon, which is basically someone who seizes land during wartime. And then the question is, how do you deal with that seizure after the war is over? When and under what circumstances and for how long can original owners potentially come back and claim it? Because there it reports that Rabbi ceded a Beit Din, v'nimnu, and they took a vote, shim shahata bifnei sikarikon shnei masar chodesh, if it was, you know, for 12 months, basically in the hand of the occupier, then that has ramifications for the reclaiming of property. And there, Rav said, they started with me. So that's a monetary case. That's not a capital case. That's about who owns a field. And Rav reports this, to which the Gemara responds quite obviously, V'ha'anan matchilin min ha-gadol k'tan. What do you mean? Mishnah said you're supposed to start with the most senior member. Amar Rabba berei de Rava, Rabba, the son of Rava, Ve'itema, and some reported in the name of Rabbi Hillel Brei de Rabbi Valz, Rabbi Hillel, the son of Rabbi Valz. Yes, here, Brei de Rabbi Valz, they move it around in this one. But if you find the tet on the page here, I'll find it later. It tells you Kach Shemo, okay? That's his name. What does he say? Shane minyana deve Rabbi dechul hum minyanai hum minatzad havu matale. Rabbi's court was unusual. No matter what the issue, they always started min hatzad, from the more junior member. Rashi's reading of this is, mipnei anava yeteira shahaitabo. Rabbi was particularly humble. And one of the ways that he manifested that humility was whenever he convened a court, he began by consulting the most junior member. All right, there's Midrashim talking about how, right, God consults the angels before creating human beings, and that's to be a model to everyone, to consult their junior colleagues. But as we see from the Mishnah, that wasn't an actual normal protocol. But Rabbi instituted in this court. All right, so that explains the anomaly of why things began with Rav. And now, Ve'amar Rabba Brei de Rava, Ve'itema Rabbi Hillel Brei de Rabbi Valz, Mimot Moshe Ve'ad Rabbi Lo Matzinu Torah U'gdula B'makom Echad. From the days of Moshe until Rabbi, there was never anyone. Now, how should we best translate this, right? Literally, it's, we don't find Torah and greatness in one place. Idiomatically, it seems to mean, from Moshe until Rabbi, there was no individual between Moshe and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi for, oh, I don't know, what is that? Like basically a 2,000 year period where deep learning and scholarship and political power were embodied in a single person. That's what I think this statement is getting at. Now, what does this have anything to do with what we're talking about? Well, there is a mention of Rabbi, and we did just talk about his court. And in that context, you might play with Gdula as meaning sort of fineness of character, but there's probably some other people who met that, and that's where I think the political power piece is relevant, in which case we're not really talking about what we were just talking about. But the reason this is here is because the Ve'amar here is the exact same sage paralleled with another sage in a unique combination that only appears here in these two statements in the entire Talmud. Right, this is a classic kovetz that is based on form as opposed to content. You want to remember all of this stuff? You want to organize it? One good way is the two statements that are Amar Rabba Brei de Rava, Ve'itema Rabbi Hillel Brei de Rabbi Valz, you redact them together, and that's how you remember them. All right, so that's really the structure of this little sugya. And now we're going to go off onto a side point of thinking about what other places, if any, were there this sort of synthesis of Torah greatness and political power. Here, how does Rashi summarize this here? B'makom echad, Toratan u'gdulatan shel Yisrael be'adam echad, she'en k'moto b'chol Yisrael b'torah u'vigdula. You're looking for one person who combines the attributes of Torah and greatness in a way that no other Jew alive does. Kegon, and now just spelling it out, Moshe, Shehaya Gadol al Kol Yisrael b'malchut uvetorah. And here Rashi is pointing us, I think, right to the political dimension. Moshe essentially functions as a king. There is no one else with equivalent power. Korach wants it, but he doesn't get it. And of course, in Torah. V'chein Rabbi, b'nisiut uvatorah. And Rabbi too has not only the Torah, but also he is the patriarch. He is the sort of political head of the Jewish community, representing it to the outside world, serving as a kind of quasi-descendant of the Davidic line, as the Nasi was thought to. And that's what makes these two figures particularly striking. And the claim is unparalleled in the intervening years. All right, so now this is going to be a great little exchange. And I'll sort of read it through quickly, and then we'll reflect on some of what's happening here and some of the characters. Velo? Really? There was no one who, between the span of time from Moshe to Rabbi Yehuda and Nasi, who didn't combine those two qualities? Ha hava Yoshua. What about Yoshua? He was no slouch. He was the political leader and also understood to be in the chain of Torah transmission. Now, hava Elazar. Elazar Kohen was around at the same time. And he functioned both as a Torah scholar and as a Kohen. That's a different kind of political leadership. So they were sort of a tag team. There wasn't an undisputed single person. Vehahava Pinchas. But what about Pinchas, Elazar's son? He was the Kohen Gadol.
Quiet.
He went out, we know, into the battlefield in the war in Midian, etc. Now, Havu Zakenim, there were other elders around. If you look at the Rashi here on the side, he says, who are the Zakenim? Kagon Otniel, the Ivtsan, Uvoaz, these other figures from the Shoftim who are around at the same time. Vehahava Shaul. Okay, what about Shaul? He was the king and also presumed to be a Torah scholar. Now, Hava Shmuel. Shmuel lived at the same time. Now we're going to complicate it a wrinkle. Vehanach Nafshe. Okay, but Shmuel dies, right? That is to say, Shaul outlives Shmuel. So once Shmuel is dead, doesn't Shaul qualify as being Torah Ugdula b'makom echad, and there's no one else? No. Kul hu shnei ka'amrinan. We're looking for someone who had that designation for their whole life. Not for part of their life, but for their whole life. For all of Moshe's life, there was no other meaningful political or religious leader who could touch him. That's not the case with Shaul. Veha hava David. Hava ira ha'ya'iri. We'll come back to him. You're like, what? Who? Okay, but ira ha'ya'iri was just as great as David. Vehanach navshe. But ira ha'ya'iri predeceased David. Now, again, kul hu shnei ka'amrinan, but he was still alive for part of David's life, so David loses this designation. Veha hava Shlomo. Okay, what about Shlomo HaMelech? Hava Shimi ben Gera. No, there was Shimi ben Gera, who was also paralleled him in at least one of these dimensions. Veha Katlei, but Shlomo kills Shimi ben Gera. It's actually one of David's deathbed's instructions to Shlomo, that he's got to kill Shimi ben Gera. Kulu shnei ka'amrinan. Again, no, but he overlapped with him somewhat. We need his whole life. Ha'ava Chizkiah. What about King Chizkiyahu, who is understood also to have been a great sort of Torah figure in addition to a king? Hava Shevna. There was this figure, Shevna. We'll come back and talk about him, who was a parallel and was sort of a threat. The Ha'iktil, but he was killed. And Chizkiyah survived him. Again, kul hu shnei ka'amrinan. No, we need someone who's got their entire life. Some of Chizkiyah's years were paralleled by Shevna. Veha hava Ezra. I think someone chatted that. No, hava Nehemiah ben Chachaliah. You've got Nehemiah waiting there on the side to take that distinction away from him. Okay, that's sort of an amazing list. There are a number of questions I think that we can ask about this list. The Tosfot ask a whole bunch of them, which are, I would say, of the sort of, hey, what about this person? What about that person? Or how do you think this through? So here, the Ha'ava Chizkiah, first we see there's some traditions here that are different. Itzvarim de lo garasle de Chizkiah. Some people didn't count Chizkiah. De Chizkiah lo haya moshel al kol Yisrael, shekvar galu aseret ha-shvatim. How can you say he's really in charge? He lost, you know, the 10 tribes are lost. Ve'od de shevna rasha haya, ve'lo miminyanahu. And also the person that you're saying competes for the title of Torah u'gdula b'makom echad, shevna, we'll come back to in a second, is wicked. Okay, going on, Viteda, no further, Dechipri, Hava David, when they say, what about David? Lo Mishane Hava Achitofel. Another person you could have thrown in, Achitofel, one of David's advisors, also thought to be a great scholar. Shekrao David Alufo Miyudao, And he refers to him in a psalm that is interpreted to be about David talking to Achitophel, you are my, you know, my sort of superior and teacher, etc. We don't count him because he's a Rasha. But what do you see the Tosfot thinking about here? The Tosfot are thinking about, aren't there other people who aren't on this list, right? What's happening here? Why don't we argue, right? Why don't we say, when we say Elazar, okay, the next Tosfot, I won't read it with you inside. When we say Elazar, we say, but there was Pinchas, right? Why didn't we say, when we say that Yoshua, when we say there was Yoshua, we say, well, there was Elazar. Why don't we then say, but there was Elazar, right? In other words, there's something about the list here that's not perfect. Structurally, just to sort of note this, switching here to here where I've sort of graphically laid it out, this is one of those sugyot you gotta count. When you actually start mapping it out and counting it, you realize there are exactly seven steps after this statement is made. Mimot Moshe ve'ad Rabbi lo matzinu Torah u'gdula b'makom echad. And then it's very clear that there's a seven-part structure here. I've bolded the people that they're calling up. These are people we can imagine them wanting to mention, right? Yeshua, Pinchas, Shaul, David, Shlomo, Chizkiah, Ezra. You basically have, four of the most prominent kings. Shaul, David, and Shlomo are obvious. Chizkiah is sort of the most significant later political king in terms of retaining some kind of political power. Yeshua and Pinchas are some of the obvious people to think of after Moshe, and Ezra is obvious, but there is also a getting to seven, and there is a desire here to mention all of those and sort of swat them down. And sometimes noting that kind of numerical structure, I find reassuring with, okay, I don't have to account for the logical or literary watertightness of this list, because it may also be doing some other work. So that I think is sort of the background of what's happening there. Sorry, let's stay here for a minute. The question is, who are some of these people? So Yoshua being counteracted by Elazar, that's obvious. Pinchas with the generic Zakenim, okay, right? That's not as well spelled out, but the Zakenim asher he'erichu yamim achar Yoshua, the very end of Sefer Yoshua and the beginning of Shoftim talks about characters who were significant in that regard. Shaul and Shmuel is an obvious pairing. The ones that start to get weird are Ira Ya'iri, Shimi ben Gera, Shevna, and then the rest makes sense, right? Those three. So just to give you a little background here, because these things always have, this is an example of a midrash within a midrash, where it's very clear that they are already aware of and responding to other traditions here. It's not like this Gemara is suddenly coming along and making up some notion that Ira Ya'iri is significant. So in Shmuel Bet, at one point, text does this in a number of places, there's sort of a pause to review the bureaucracy that's in place at the time. So it says, V'yoav el kol hatzava Yisrael, Yoav is the general, Benaya ben Yehoyada la kretiv ala pleti, which seems to be some kind of elite bodyguard. Adoram ala mas, he's the in charge of the forced labor brigades. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud amazkir, some kind of secretary, recorder. Shva sofer, a scribe. Tzadok ve'evyatar kohanim, they are the priests. Vegam ira hayairi haya kohen leDavid. Now that's a weird phrase. What does that mean? He was a Kohen for David. The Pshat probably means Tzadok and Eviatar are famous people. You know who they are. They were Kohanim in the time of David. You should also know that Ira Hayairi was also a Kohen, though he's less well known, Li David in the sense of in the time of David. But Li David, of course, has the connotation sort of for David, right? It, almost like he was his personal priest. Now, that doesn't make any sense in terms of any normative understanding of the priesthood. And so therefore, there clearly was a whole midrashic tradition that understood Kohen le David to be some form of he was David's Rav. He was David's teacher. And here you see one nice reading of that in the Gemara in Eruvin, which this sugya is clearly aware of. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, kol ha-moreh halacha bifnei rabo ra'ui lach kisho nachash. If someone teaches a halacha in the presence of their teacher, that is to say, presumes to be giving a normative ruling in the presence of their superior, they deserve to be bitten by a snake. Ze'eri says in the name of Rabbi Hanina, Nikra Chote, and moreover, they're called a sinner, Shene'emar, and now this is from Tehillim, from Psalms. So remember, this is David speaking, Bilibi tzafanti imratecha lema'an lo echetalach. I have hidden your sayings in my heart so that I wouldn't sin to you, which is basically read as, I have hidden in my heart God's teachings. That is to say, I have suppressed a halacha that I wanted to teach so that I would not sin to you, God, by dishonoring my teacher who's in my presence. So we see here a verse that you sometimes have to withhold something that you know that you want to teach because you are not the most senior person present. Now, Rav Hamnuna comes in and says, wait a minute, there's two verses that are in conflict. One verse says, Bilibi tzafanti imratecha, but there's another verse that says, Bisarti tzedek bekahal rav. I made known righteousness in a great assembly, meaning in front of everyone, I taught the things I knew to be right. And what's the conclusion? Lakashya. How do we resolve this in terms of David's life? David went around his whole life, basically, and as long as Ira Ya'iri was a Kohen to him, he shut his mouth and didn't teach any halachot. After Ira Ya'iri died, so then he went crazy and became renowned. Clearly picking up on this, right, in building our seven-part thing, our sugya then says, basically, that's why we can't count David as this sort of singular figure of Torah Ugdula b'makom echad. Similarly, Shimi ben Gera, the claim here is always live near your teacher because you'll be embarrassed to do certain things in the presence of your teacher. You'll behave better. What's the proof? As long as Shimi ben Gera was alive, Shlomo did not marry Paro's daughter. Now this is bizarre, but actually is sort of a sensitive reading of the beginning of Sefer Melachim. Because what happens is, at the beginning of Sefer Melachim, David gives this deathbed charge, the Haftarah for Vayechi, Perek Bet, where he's like, here's all the unfinished business. I had all the people that I didn't get rid of, or you got to take care of Barzillai Agiladi. It reads much better and if you read it with sort of like a Marlon Brando undertone, it really captures the mood. But in any event, you've got this whole set of executions that basically David wants Shlomo to carry out, which includes Shimi ben Gera, Kihu kilalani kilalani meretzet, he cursed me in this horrible way, and therefore, you gotta not have mercy on him. Shlomo basically grants him the possibility of house arrest, but then Shimi ben Gera leaves, breaks his house arrest, and he has Benayahu finish him off. And then the next pasuk is Vayitchaten Shlomo et bat Paro, that he married the daughter of Paro, and the daughter of Paro is one of the people who eventually right leads him astray into idolatry, and it's sort of Shlomo's downfall. So, reflecting on that juxtaposition, Ula here imagines that Shimi ben Gera kept Shlomo in check. And that's why we are told that upon his death, Shlomo married Bat Paro. But the more important thing here is that Shimi ben Gera is in that sense cast as a teacher, a Torah figure, who is alive at the time of Shlomo. And therefore that knocks Shlomo out, who you would think Shlomo is the ultimate candidate, right? For Torah Ugdula b'makom echad. Shimi ben Gera knocks out that possibility, okay? All right, so That's Irai Yairi and Shimi Ben Gera. We won't get into Shevna, but Shevna is a whole bunch of other midrashim. You can search it and find because of a bizarre passage in Yishayahu where Yishayahu yells at Shevna Asher al Habayit and says you're going to be exiled and buried in a faraway land. He's understood to be some kind of usurper to the throne. Okay, where does the sugya end? Amar Rav Ada Bar Ava, Af Ani Omer, Mimot Rabbi Ad Rav Ashi, Lo Matzinu Torah Ugdula B'Makom Echad. So now going from a smaller window of time, but 200 to 400, Rav Ashi also was the first person since Rabbi, basically the only person in the Amoraic period, is the claim, who also embodied Torah greatness and some kind of communal power in some way. And then the Gemara says, Velo, v'ha'ava Huna Bar Natan. But there was Huna Bar Natan. And you're like, who is Huna Bar Natan? He's not even Rav. We'll come back to him in a minute, but the way we resolve that is, Huna Bar Natan mechav hava chayef le the Rav Ashi. Huna Bar Natan was sort of subservient to, deferential to, saw himself as the inferior, the subordinate of Rav Ashi. Now, who's Huna Bar Natan? So this is referring to this story in the Bavli and Zvachim. Amar Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi says, Amar li Huna Bar Natan. Huna Bar Natan told me, Zimna chada hava ka'emna kame de izgedar malka. I was once standing in the presence of King Yazdegerd. This is Yazdegerd the first, the Sasanian king, who is known, and you'll see this story is sort of part data, part confirmation, known to be very friendly to the Jews. He was less friendly, he was less popular with the Zoroastrians, and he was good to the Jews and the Christians. He was standing in the presence of the Sasanian Persian king. V'hava madle li hem yanai v'tete nihale. And he lowered my belt to a lower part of where it was, meaning Huna Bar Natan was wearing his belt high up in a way that King Yazdegerd did not think was sufficiently regal, and he told him to lower the belt to that more regal place, saying to him, "The Amar Li." And what did he say to me? Mamlechet Kohanim v'goy kadosh k'tiv b'cho. It says about you people that you're supposed to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So wear your belt properly. It's like, you know, he's straightening his tie. You got to look good. You people are royalty. Ki atai kamei de'amemar. When I came, says Huna Bar Natan, to Amemar, he said to me, ah, through you has been fulfilled the verse, kings will be your nursemaids. Look at this, you have the king of the Sasanian Empire fixing your belt. That is the fulfillment of the prophecy in Isaiah. Okay, that's clearly the intertext for this notion that Huna Bar Natan had this sort of significant political power and that he was also a scholar. Therefore, he should have knocked out Rav Ashi for this distinctive title. But no, because he treated himself not as an equal, but as a subordinate to Rav Ashi, that allows him to retain that specific privileged title. Okay? That's the end of that little sugya. Which, as you can see, is mostly about just sort of questions of greatness and thinking about. I think I saw Sally say there's a lot of name dropping, and there's sort of a review in some way of who are the people we think they're significant and who is unique, right? In some way, does the alternate need to have both Torah and political power knock off the proffered winner? What do you think, Ezra? What's your hunch?
Well, Shimon ben Gera was a villain, so no, you only need one.
Well, so the villain thing, I think, is complicated, right? And that's what the Tosfot are grappling with. I would also say, Shimi does something David doesn't like. I think it's not entirely clear in all the Midrashim if they think of Shimi as being a villain, or they think of him having just gotten on the wrong side of David, been a Moreid Bamalchut, and therefore, because of taking rebellious action, being culpable for that. I think there is a plausible reading of the sugya that you only need one, right? If you look at Rashi, right, Shevna is Shehaya Yeshivato Gdola Mishel Chizkiya, right? He's only mentioning sort of his yeshiva, his place where there's learning. And I think actually the earlier Rashi, yeah, it depends how you read this, right? The earlier Rashi, Toratanu Gdulatan Shel Yisrael Be'adam Echad, She'en Kmoto Bechol Yisrael, B'Torah Uvegdula. Question is whether that Vav is conjunctive or disjunctive. You could read it both ways. And even with the Shevna comment, he's commenting on his learning. That may be, though, because his political power of being Asher al-Abayit was self-evident. So I suspect if you probe the medieval commentators, you'd probably find a split in that regard.
I think Rashi on Elazar also indicates it's just one.
Right, Chaveru Batorah. Unless you take his kehuna as self-evident in some ways of having that. But then you're right, there always would have been a Kohen Gadol. Yeah, that's probably right. That's probably right. I suspect you'd find some slightly divergent ways of reading it. Separation of powers. I mean, right. The question is how much do we want this to be the case, right? Is it a good thing when Torah and Gdula are b'makom echad, or we're just noting when it happens, but maybe it's better when it doesn't, or maybe there's a comment that it's rare because there's some kind of danger. Overall seems to be an approving statement by Rabbi Hillel Bari de Rabbi Valls. But I think in terms of what the sugya is doing with it and asking about these seven alternatives, I don't know. It's an interesting question. Just looking at some of the other comments here, different styles of leadership, collaborative leadership, et cetera. Seven groupings, similar. Well, you find seven groupings all over the place. You find threes, you find sevens, you find fives too. But for long lists, seven is all over the place. In kvatzim, in collections of various materials, by topic or by sage, but also in this kind of case with Shakla Vitaria. And that's very much bound up with mnemonics, right? It's part of how you remember lists like this. So great. Okay. Let's move on to our next sugya. I think we can at least start it. Then we'll round out. All right. So, dine nefashot, the other half of this, matchilim min hatzad. Capital cases, however, we begin from the side, as we said. That is to say, in monetary cases, you begin from the top, unless you're in Rabbi's court, who ironically seems to have been, right, the most, or maybe not ironically, right, he's both the most humble person ever because he runs his court that way. And then, of course, we know Moshe is the most humble man as described by the Torah. And then we've got Rabbi grouped. That's something interesting to think about, like Moshe and Rabbi both manifesting this humility and then both being entrusted on some level with Torah Ugdula. That may be another way of answering your question, Jed. It may not be about a separation of powers as much as it is. It takes a certain kind of character to be able to pull that off, or maybe for God to grant that to them. But in any event, the normal situation is that only in Dinei Nefashot Matrili Minatza. Menane Mile. How do we know that? Where does that come from? Amar Avacha Bar Papa, Amar Kra, Lo Ta'ane Al Riv, Lo Ta'ane Al Rav. There's a pasuk. The pasuk says, "Lo ta'ane, lo tihya acharei rabim leraot, ve'lo ta'ane al riv lintot acharei rabim lehatot." What does the plain sense mean? A plain sense is, don't speak up with respect to a dispute, lintot acharei rabim le'atot, in order to lean to one side in the judgment in a biased way, in order to sort of join a whole group of people who are trying to pervert the judgment in a certain way. Lo ta'ane al riv literally means don't speak up in the context of a dispute, where the end of the verse in the pshat is key, which is don't speak up in order or in a manner where you are going to have this this kind of motivation and this kind of effect. But taken on its own, lo ta'ane al riv is don't speak up in the context of a dispute. Well, that can't be. And in particular, if you read locally, Riv is spelled without a yud. And that means when you're reading the Torah without the vowels, what it looks like is Lo ta'anel rav. Do not speak up with respect to a teacher. Okay. Meaning, okay, so Amar Avacha Bar Papa Amar Krav, playing with the chaser, lacking yud spelling here, lo ta'ane al riv, lo ta'ane al rav. So let's look here. Lo ta'ane al riv, k'tiv belo yud. Mashma, lo tachlok al muflash al beit din. That implies you are not allowed to speak up against a teacher, against someone who is more superior. Hilkach, lo matchelinan mine, dil machazale chova, velo palgina ilave, umatchilin minatzad, shelo yishma echad divre echad mina mezakim v'yaskim imo. Okay, so how does this work? You're not allowed to reject what the first person, what the most senior person has said. Therefore, you don't start from the most senior person. So note how this is being read. Again, I think the plain sense you probably would have guessed in the Mishnah is you don't want to cow the more junior members of the court into following the opinion of the most senior member. But here it's read a little differently, which is actually they're not really allowed to contradict the most senior member, okay? Or at least that's what they'll think the verse means. Therefore, don't start from the most senior member, lest that person think that the person on trial needs to be convicted, and no one will disagree with them because they will perceive that to be in violation of disagreeing with that leader. Therefore, you start from the side, okay? And that's what opens up the dimension of disagreement. Now, in theory, this verse could, you know, be applied to Dine Mamonot as well, right? But the idea is that you don't have the same exact kind of verdict. It's more like sort of a finding, I think, of like, okay, this person knows that person, et cetera. Here it's like, I said guilty, right? You said innocent. And the stakes are also being read higher here. Lo ta'ane al riv, well, that's something we're worried is going to play out in a capital case. Yeah, the question of how much is this, right, is the Menahane Mile here really sort of saying this is what establishes the rule, or is this sort of explaining the ethos? Here, look over here on the Tosfot. Dinei nefashot matrilin min atzad, mishum lo ta'ane al riv. Because of that principle of, well, you're not allowed to disagree with the teacher, so you have to start from the side. Aval b'dinei mamonot lo chayshina. We don't worry about that in the context of dinei mamonot. So that language of lo chayshina clarifies, right? Tosfot understand it very clearly that, of course, there's no ban on voting differently than the chief justice, as it were. But because there's this general ethos of lo ta'ane al rav, which is to say you don't normally speak up against your teacher in that way, and it goes back to the Moreh Halacha Bifnei Rabo that we just talked about in the previous sugya, we're worried people are going to be silenced, right? We don't worry about that in monetary cases because the gravity seems to be less. Okay. Tosfot go on to explore that a little further, but that seems to be part of what's being played out here. All right, that's one derivation. Rabba Bar Bar Chana Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mehacha, Vayomer David Lanashav, Chigru Ishet Harbo, Vayachgeru Ishet Harbo, Vayachgor Gam David Et Harbo. So he learns from somewhere different, perhaps because he's not comfortable with some of the ramifications of that first reading in terms of when you might be silenced. He says, watch David when he goes out to war. He says to his men, you all put on your you know, bind up your swords. And they each bound up their swords. And then he bound up his sword. That is to say, we see that his protocol, it was the protocol here was get them to put on their swords before you put on your own. David went last. All right. And that's where we learn that that's the case. And where is he saying this, right? This is the, it's not just sort of going to war. If you look at Rashi, the rabbinic context that's given to this, let's just get, where's the pasuk here? 3, up here they bring it on the side. Shmuel Aleph Kaf Hey, okay. And here, so wait, what's, hold on. Now I'm getting confused here. We're in Kaf Hey. What story are we in? If anyone else remembers it, you can jump in here. Shmuel Aleph Kaf Hey. Let's pull it up here.
It's Naval. It's the story of Naval.
Naval, yes. Okay, great. Correct. So Naval HaKarmeli, right? This is the whole scene. He doesn't give David, depending how you read it, either his protection money or the honor due to him, but one way or the other. It's determined, it's certainly a rabbinic formulation, that Naval becomes a Mored B'Malchut. He's a rebel against the rightful king. And so when David goes out to kill him with his people, so if you look at Rashi, right? Vayachgor Gam David Harbo, Ba'achrona nimnu alav leduno mishum moreid b'malchut. Okay, they right. Vayachgor gam David harbo ba'achrona. He's the last one to put on his sword, which the midrash here is understanding as yeah, a sword. I mean, they're going to kill him, but what they really were doing was having a vote. Right. One of the things that's fascinating about this whole passage, it's both with the Torah Udula, and it's also with this case of David, and this obviously for people who have seen it runs through all of Chazal, all of the Talmud, is both the rabbinization of these figures and also sort of the bureaucratization of some of the sort of warlord violence scenes in the Tanakh, which things that really just seem like people going out and killing people and executing people become scenes of capital punishment in a properly functioning court. You know, this is another theme I think it's sort of interesting to reflect on. We've talked on throughout this chapter, like what's Chazal's relationship to capital punishment? And one thing I've pushed is they simultaneously sort of want to minimize it and limit it and put tremendous safeguards on it. And they are also, I've argued to you, invested in not eliminating it. That is to say, it really represents something very important to them in theory. Sort of the only way to really capture the gravity of certain crimes, particularly murder, is to emphasize that the taking of a life is the only way to really kind of get any kind of even response to that. But another dimension that I think this brings out is the frame of capital punishment is also a way for them to domesticate a whole set of stories that otherwise threaten to be about a whole mode of vigilante justice, which instead become basically manifestations of a commitment to Torah and statecraft and judicial procedure and ways in which we learn, you know, how figures of power are supposed to interact. So that's another thing, right? I think it's always important to remember for Chazal, we're not just dealing with legal theorists coming up with like, how should we run a republic? We're dealing also with interpreters of scripture who are accountable to all kinds of narratives that involve killing, And at a certain point, you get into a choice. Well, I have a couple of choices. I can either throw those narratives overboard and their characters overboard. Sometimes that happens with some critique, but mostly that's not going to work. You can embrace sort of just the messiness, the Wild West nature of it, which has its own threats in terms of continuity and kind of legitimacy of those characters. Or you can find ways of saying, well, they were actually carrying out procedures that are meant to be part of a law-abiding society. That can be another strong motivation for sort of keeping this alive, as it were, in some way, as something we want to understand, right? And understand how it plays out. Yeah, from the battlefield into the Beit Midrash. And yeah, the stuff about David, it comes up time and time again. And that was an interesting next chapter in the New Yorker. Any other comments on this or what we've seen? We're gonna pause here. We're really still in the next sugya, in the middle of the next sugya, but it's a good breaking point with Rav's statement to pick up next time. Other thoughts about the rabbinization here, any of the themes that we've talked about, or any other questions about the figures we've seen? Okay. Well, I think we will leave it there for this week. Looking forward to see you again next week. We'll pick up from that sugya and plow forward. It'll be a little more legal and textual next time. But as I said, the Agadah is going to start coming fast and furious before you know. See you in a week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.